This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. This is the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks so much for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of October 20th, 2025. In Tribal Natural Resources, which is supported in part by a grant from the Katina Foundation, Resolution Copper has touted a massive mining project east of Phoenix as an economic boom for Arizona that, at full scale, could produce enough finished product to meet 25% of the nation's copper demand. But once that critical mineral is extracted from the ground, it will leave the copper state entirely. Where exactly is this precious Arizona resource going? In the first of a two-part series, Gabriel Pietrazio treks to Utah to see the smelting operation that's likely to refine the Arizona ore.
Resolution Copper has no other choice, at least in the U.S., but to ship that copper concentrate over 700 miles by rail across state lines to Rio Tinto Kennecott's Garfield smelter on the outskirts of Salt Lake City. Even Phoenix rival Freeport-McMoRan, which owns the only other U.S. smelter near Miami, Arizona, already does so.
The intent, the desire, the ability for us to do that is 100% there. We just need to see a time frame and a level of certainty before we can kind of make final plans.
Kennecott Managing Director Nate Foster says his team has been in talks about having its subsidiary send their supply to Utah since Rio Tinto is the majority shareholder of foreign-owned Resolution Copper. Their smelter is housed near the historic Bingham Canyon Mine, hidden by the Ochre Mountains, where it's taken 120 years to dig 3/4 of a mile down. Chris Burson is a haul truck operator and escorts my bumpy ride to the bottom of what's considered to be the world's deepest open pit mine.
It's about 15 to 20 minutes downhill, depending on road condition, right? And then uphill is a 35 to 45 minute crawl.
Sharing the muddy road with trucks tipping the scale at over 1 million pounds. They dump the ore into a crusher where the rock is then sent on a 5-mile conveyor belt to senior metallurgist Josh Dedamanti and his crew.
Basically, this is where the magic happens. We add chemicals that bind specifically to copper minerals.
Then traces of the metal begin bubbling.
Literally, that copper floats to the surface, and that's what feeds the smelter.
Beyond their own mine, Rio Tinto also relies on copper concentrate being sent from companies like Freeport and its massive Morenci mine in Greenlee County, says smelter advisor Bob Gardner. Resolution Copper could soon become another supplier.
Up here with all these empty rail cars, that's where we receive all the third-party concentrate at, so we can put it into our flash smelting furnace.
Burning around 2,400 degrees Fahrenheit, roughly a fifth as hot as the surface temperature of the sun. Then that copper is further refined using an electrical current.
No pacemakers. You guys are young enough that you don't need them, right? Because in the tank house, there's an electrical field out there, and it'll mess with your pacemaker, so we don't want to set anybody into cardiac arrest.
Third-generation Kennecott employee Brian Bergstrom really considers himself a copper farmer.
Because we plant the anode, plant the stainless steel blank in between them. We grow it for 14 days, and then we harvest. And in between, we pull weeds.
So in the tank house, we can grow at any one time up to 64,000 cathodes.
Sheets are bathed in a pungent solution made from copper sulfate and sulfuric acid.
After about 2 weeks here, you don't smell it anymore.
Machinery cleans and pries the copper from stainless steel. Each 300-pound sheet of American-made copper is stamp-punched and stacked into bundles that are directly sold to manufacturers, mostly wire and pipe producers in the Midwest. Their warehouse is like the Fort Knox of copper.
Got about 14,000 sheets in here right now. And again, everything that we produce today will be ready to put on a rail car or a truck tomorrow. So we try to not hold on to it very long. There's very few places, if any, in the mining world where you go from digging dirt to finished product within a few mile radius.
The Copper State won't be one of those one-stop shops for Resolution Copper, but Utah could become that spot unless current court challenges prevail.
Once it gets approved and we can start bringing some of that ore here, that sustains Utah and Salt Lake Valley for another 120 years or more.
For KJZZ News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Rio Tinto Kennecott.
Find the whole series on our website, kjzz.org. In business news, through our Q&AZ reporting project, a listener asked, why do the Phoenix Suns have a gorilla for a mascot? As Bridget Dowd reports, the gorilla, which remains one of the most recognizable and popular mascots in the NBA, was born quite by accident.
Go to any Phoenix Suns game and you're bound to see a gorilla taking pictures with fans or helping in-game hosts give out prizes. But nowadays, he's probably best known for his stunts.
During halftime or timeout, he was jumping on the trampoline and then he was like doing flips and whatnot and dunking it.
That Suns fan Chase Tallman before a recent preseason game describing what he's seen the gorilla do at past regular season games he's attended.
It's very entertaining for the little ones and the adults.
Nearby, Titus Converse described the gorilla as one of the most iconic mascots in all of sports.
I genuinely think the Suns gorilla is the top two mascot in the league, and he's not number two.
But while the gorilla is expected to be at a Suns game today, fans were certainly not expecting him when he first stepped onto the court at Arizona Veterans Memorial Coliseum during the 1979-80 season. Inside the suit was a 23-year-old Henry Rojas.
I needed some extra money, and my sister talked me into taking a job singing telegrams with a company called Eastern Onion.
So Rojas started delivering musical messages, typically dressed in a tuxedo, but he was also a diehard Suns fan.
I had told Eastern Onion, if you ever get a telegram to a Suns game, I'd like to have it because I'd like to sit watch the rest of the game, but I'm thinking in the tuxedo.
Eventually, someone did request a telegram to be delivered at a Suns game, but there was a catch.
They didn't tell me until a day or two before that the people were paying extra for the telegram singer to wear a gorilla suit.
Rojas actually didn't want to do it and tried to get out of the gig, but ultimately drove to the game in a gorilla suit. He told workers what he was there to do, and an usher was supposed to take him up to the seats, but never did.
And I can't leave the court because I'm near the edge of the court and the game's going on. So a timeout's called, and then they start playing music.
Rojas says the music got the best of him and he started dancing. Fans loved it, and at the next timeout, staffers were pushing him back onto the court.
The official tells me to go to the free throw line and throw me the ball. I could barely see the basket through my mask. I had sweat dropping into my eyes, and I flipped the shot up and I hit the free throw. Swish it.
When his radio alarm clock woke him up the next day,
it's the old KOI radio program. Sandy Gibbons and Bill Haywood talking about the girl at the game that night. Who was that guy? And I'm jumping on my bed. It was me.
Rojas later ended up on another radio program where they asked him why he didn't just perform at all the games.
And I said, nope, I would never be a gatecrasher. So then fictitious telegrams started being sent by people to get the gorilla to the game.
Rojas continued using his improv skills to entertain fans, and eventually the team invited him to be an official part of game day. But at the time, teams didn't have cheerleaders or entertainment departments, so Rojas had to do odd jobs in the summer.
So I would go into the Suns office, and then I went by a different name and called season ticket holders, did whatever.
But he eventually carved out a place for himself, acting as the primary entertainment in two NBA All-Star games and outselling players in merchandise, not by imitating a gorilla, but by playing a gorilla who wanted to be more human. One of his favorite moments was coming out to music from the Rocky movie and running up the steps of the Coliseum.
When I got to the very top, I was standing in the general admission seats that my uncle used to take me to my son's game. And I high-fived those people. And I think that was the moment I realized I've connected to the little guy.
One of his signature bits was poking fun at players from the other team who got in trouble that week.
And not just players, movies. Like back then, Beverly Hills Cop was a big hit with Eddie Murphy.
That's Ronnie Williams, who started as a ball boy with the Suns, but ended up being the right-hand man for Rojas.
And we would run to the store and pick up a shirt and a hoodie and portray Eddie Murphy.
Williams remembers a lot of trips to Goodwill to find props for Rojas's spur-of-the-moment ideas. Rojas also became a mentor to then 12-year-old Williams.
It seemed like the greater our relationship got, the more the gorilla grew in my heart and a lot of the fans' hearts.
Williams eventually went off to college, and Rojas decided to shed the gorilla suit to pursue other endeavors. He says he never expected the character to live on when he left, but realized every spectator had a memory with the gorilla, and he's happy to see fans continue to make memories today.
Even now at 67, this thing never ends. I got grandkids. I would love for them to see what I used to do and where I was, and it's been the greatest thing to embrace it.
Bridget Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
That's the end of the third quarter. Your Suns 89, the Lakers 83.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. There are a lot of opportunities for fun across the valley. With so many choices, let KJZZ narrow it down. Sign up for KJZZ's Hotspots, and every Wednesday, we'll send some ideas to your phone in a text message. Visit hotspots.kjzz.org to get started. In politics news, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays filed a lawsuit Tuesday against House Speaker Mike Johnson over his refusal to swear Democratic Congresswoman-elect Adelita Grijalva into office. From the politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
Grijalva was elected on September 23rd to represent Congressional District 7, which encompasses a large chunk of southern Arizona. She's been waiting for Johnson to swear her in for the last month. Johnson's a Republican and says he won't swear Grijalva in until Democrats agree to back off their demands and reopen the government. Grijalva and other Arizona Democrats have accused Johnson of stalling to avoid her acting as the deciding vote to force the release of the Epstein files. In any event, Mays argues Johnson's stalling is actually illegal under the federal constitution. She accuses him of subjecting Arizonans to taxation without representation. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In Fronteras News. In 2024, nearly $400 million worth of live cattle crossed into Arizona from Mexico on foot. This year, the number of cattle that have crossed that border have plummeted as the U.S. tries to stop the northward spread of a flesh-eating parasite. Part of their method? Closing the U.S.-Mexico border to cattle. The most recent closure has lasted for months, putting pressure on ranchers in Sonora, reports Nina Kravinsky from the Fronteras desk in Hermosillo, Sonora.
On a warm October morning, Gila monsters lumber across the sandy dirt road to Rancho Grande. Here, in the desert between Hermosillo and Nogales, you can hear the cattle before you see them. This more than 7,000-acre ranch is one of five the Fimbres family owns here in Sonora. Ranching is an important industry in the Mexican state south of Arizona, where most cattle is raised to be exported to the U.S. But now, the cattle that have been this family's cash crop for four generations are trapped on this side of the border as the U.S. seeks to stop the spread of a deadly flesh-eating parasite called the New World Screwworm. The parasite hasn't reached Sonora, at least not yet. Rancher Jesus Fimbres is frustrated that his perfectly healthy cattle are locked out of a U.S. market they were bred for. Right now, the truth is that times have been extremely difficult, Fimbres says. The ceiling soar and heads of deer and bighorn sheep line the walls of the Fimbres family ranch house. The property doubles as a hunting lodge frequented by American tourists. Peacocks wander near the pool. 71-year-old Fimbres shows me a new tool here on the ranch, one his father and grandfather didn't have to worry about when they crisscrossed their livestock across the same desert. A plastic baggie and canister to send larva samples he might find to authorities monitoring the screwworm's path. The state is beefing up safety protocols like this. That's created an extra expense for ranchers like Fimbres, who lose money every day the border stays closed. But Sonoran officials hope these efforts will convince the U.S. to reopen the border, at least their section. There's no clear sign the U.S. Department of Agriculture will do that soon.
We have to protect our cattle industry and our beef industry in this country, and in so doing, protect our food supply, and in so doing, protect our national security for America.
That's USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins at a press conference in Texas over the summer to announce plans to strengthen the U.S.'s defense against the parasite. The U.S. eradicated the New World screwworm half a century ago, but over the past year, the parasite has breached what was long a containment zone in Central America, and cases have ballooned in southern Mexico. This fall, a case of the screwworm larva was found less than 100 miles from the Texas-Mexico border. Philip Kaufman is the head of the entomology department at Texas A&M University.
We want this border back open, but we have to open the border smartly so that we protect our animal agricultural industries, because we stand to lose billions of dollars if this comes in.
Screwworm infestations can devastate cattle herds and spread to other warm-blooded animals, including humans. As the threat of a screwworm invasion looms and the border closure drags on, grocery store shoppers in the U.S. are already seeing record-high price tags in the beef aisle, says Barrett Nelson, an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Closing the borders to Mexican cattle coming to the United States certainly restricts supply and definitely puts some upward pressure on our beef prices.
Uncooked beef prices in the U.S. have gone up more than 10% over the past year, according to federal data, far outpacing the overall rate of inflation. But Nelson says if the New World screwworm were to cross the border, that would be far more cataclysmic to the beef market than the border shutdown. In Sonora, Fimbres and other ranchers have been forced to sell their cattle domestically at much lower prices than they would get in the U.S. The screwworm-induced pinch comes after years of other pressures on the region's ranching industry, like intense drought and a younger generation that's less interested in ranching, says Jesus Ancheta, a rancher and spokesperson for the Sonoran Ranchers Union. It's been very demotivating, every day more so, Ancheta says. Back at Rancho Grande, Fimbres hops out of an electric pickup truck to move one of his herds to their feeding pasture. Cattle stream toward the bright green grass and alfalfa that blanket geometrical swaths of land, thanks to the water spraying from giant sloping sprinklers. That water keeps getting harder and more expensive to get his hands on, Fimbres tells me. Despite the drought and despite the border shutdown, the circle of life here on the ranch continues. It's satisfying, Fimbres says, as we watch his cattle rush toward food.
Life. That's life.
Nina Kravinsky, KJZZ News at Rancho Grande in Carbó, Sonora.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news. The University of Arizona has joined at least six other schools rejecting an offer for preferential access to federal funds in exchange for signing a compact to enact conservative policies favored by the Trump administration. Kathy Ritchie reports.
In a statement to the campus community, the U of A's president said that while a number of the proposals deserve thoughtful consideration, principles like academic freedom, merit-based research funding, and institutional independence must be preserved. Though the school did submit what it calls a statement of principles to the Department of Education, detailing what university officials called its clear standards, transparency, and accountability. Though not among the initial nine schools the Trump administration offered the compact to, Arizona State University officials confirmed they too have been in dialogue with the White House over, quote, innovative approaches to serve the needs of the country. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
In science news. A new study has found that groundwater pumping is having a greater effect in changing levels in the Tucson Basin aquifer than climate change. Greg Haney has more on the findings.
The researchers say water tables dropped by as much as 105 feet during dry periods since about the end of the last ice age. However, that is only half of the drop seen in the last 70 years due to groundwater depletion. In fact, the study found that people are depleting water faster than even the wettest periods observed could restore the aquifer. Study author Jennifer McIntosh is a hydrology and atmospheric science professor at the U of A.
Even if we were to go back to the end of the last ice age and have huge amounts of recharge, humans are extracting more groundwater out of the Tucson Basin aquifer than would be naturally recharged.
The authors say mapping the timeline of recharge will provide critical information to resource managers in the basin area. Greg Haney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And finally, from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here's essayist Robert Pala. After a principal tried to crush his tiger beat dreams, he is living his revenge.
I am walking to the principal's office, and I can probably find it blindfolded. Not quite 10 years old, I am, according to most adults and many of my classmates, completely incorrigible. My sins are numerous. I refuse to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I insist on spelling my first name incorrectly. I dress like a chorus boy from a Las Vegas floor show. I've spent hours discussing these transgressions with Mr. Cordes, the principal of the public school I attend. I'm humming a song from the new Partridge Family album as I head to Principal Cordes' office to discuss my latest wickedness. According to my fourth grade history teacher, I've announced my desire to be a woman. Come in, Bobby, Principal Cordes calls out when I arrive. Nobody calls me Bobby, which I've reminded Principal Cordes of every time I've seen him, and which he always ignores. You know why I've asked you here, right? He says as I settle onto the vinyl sofa in his Spartan office. I glance around the room. For some decorating advice? This is our shtick. Principal Cordes pretends to care about my welfare, and I make believe that he's the straight man in a comedy routine about a naughty kid who's forced to talk to a creep. Principal Cordes ignores my response and holds up a piece of paper. Mr. Cole showed me this, he says. Apparently you think it's funny to want to be a woman. I used to call Mr. Cole by his first name, Carlton, until Principal Cordes made me stop. Mr. Cole is one of those sad adults who wants kids to like him. He ends each quiz with a nonsense question, a clumsy attempt at being cool. What's George Washington's favorite meal? Mr. Cole asked last week on a quiz about the siege of Yorktown. What's your dad's first name? He had asked the week before. Normally, I answer these questions with as much scorn as I can muster, because this last question on the quiz is a freebie. No response is wrong. George Washington's favorite meal, I wrote, was Hamburger Helper. My father's name is Liberace. The final question on yesterday's quiz about Valley Forge was classic Carlton Cole. What do you want to be when you grow up? This week, I decided to answer Mr. Cole's silly question with the truth. When I grew up, I wrote, I wanted to be Ann Moses. Ann Moses had the best job in the whole world. She was the editor of Tiger Beat, a glossy magazine full of pinups and stories about the grooviest TV stars and rock singers. As far as I could tell, Ann got paid to hang out with David Cassidy and Bobby Sherman and Donny Osmond and then go back to the Tiger Beat offices and write about the fun time she had with our faves. I was only a kid, but I'd been worried for a really long time that I was ever going to find anything to do for a living. Hanging out with faves seemed like something I could do. I already had the wardrobe. Unable to find clothing in Phoenix department stores like what the Brady Bunch and the Osmonds wore on TV, I had convinced my mother to make them for me. Armed with the latest issue of Tiger Beat, Mom and I would head off to Hancock Fabrics, where I chose the loudest, most psychedelic material I could find. Back home, Mom would cut tissue paper patterns based on photos of Eve Plum's Elephant Bells and Jermaine Jackson's groovy plaid dashiki. She even made me an exact replica of the navy vest and bell-bottoms costume the Partridge Family wore when they sang each week on their TV show. I wore it to school on my 9th birthday. I added a gold ascot that matched my ruffled dress shirt. While Principal Cordes is droning on and on about how little boys should want to be astronauts or firefighters when they grow up, I was daydreaming about my own ideal future. I would move to Hollywood and go to work at Tiger Beat, just like Ann Moses. After spending the morning hanging out with Sally Field on the set of The Flying Nun, I'd meet Patty Duke for lunch at Trader Vic's and then dash across town for a quick drink at the Brown Derby with Davy Jones. Back at Tiger Beat's Hollywood Boulevard office, I'd trade stories about faves with Ann while our production staff began laying out my next scoop. I think about explaining all this to Principal Cordes, but I know it's pointless. He wants me to be a basketball player, and what I want is to interview Danny Bonaducci about his favorite color. Eventually, Principal Cordes stops talking. Look, I say, this is all a misunderstanding. Ann Moses is a cool lady who works at a magazine, and I want that kind of work one day, too. The magazine part, not the lady part. Also, Ann and I are going to be friends when I grow up. And guess what, Mr. Cordes, we have the same birthday. I know this because I read it in Tiger Beat. Principal Cordes arches an eyebrow. I give up trying to get this old guy to hear me. I was just making a joke, I mumble. I guess Mr. Cole didn't get it. My grade school principal sighs. When it comes to your future career plans, he says, handing me back my history quiz and pointing to the door, maybe set your sights a little lower. As I head back to class, I notice that Mr. Cole has marked my Ann Moses answer incorrect. It's 50 years later, and I'm out for my morning walk. Several blocks ahead, I spot the gray slump block grammar school I attended a half century ago. As I head toward it, I'm humming along to the Partridge Family album playing in my AirPods. The phone in my pocket rings and I answer it. Hey, Ann Moses says right into my ear, what are we doing for our birthday? I laugh out loud. You know I'm making you a blood orange olive oil cake and coming over to your house for lunch. Ann thinks my cake will go great with the veal shank she's planned for our annual birthday dinner at her home in Gilbert, where she lives now. Last year, she made grilled shrimp, and I baked us a pistachio cream cake. The year before that, Anne gave me a set of bright orange kitchen canisters she'd had in her Hollywood apartment during her Tiger Beat days. I look at these canisters every day, and I think, I am friends with Ann Moses. She gives me vintage Tupperware. While I walk, Ann and I talk about our husbands and compare notes on achy joints and the turmoil caused by our new president. She tells me about the Donny Osmond documentary she's been asked to appear in, and I complain about the cover story I'm writing for the newspaper where I've worked for 30 years. It's not Tiger Beat, but it pays the bills. What do you want me to make with that veal shank? Ann asks. She's a really good cook. Her entrees are even better than her profiles of teenage pop superstars. Can I have some of your polenta, I reply. Ann, you make the best polenta. Is polenta your all-time fave dish, she asks. And then Ann Moses and I burst out laughing. Take that, Mr. Cordes.
And this has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation and Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation and Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online, and on the KJZZ mobile app.